Welcome to episode 149 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Sudokuvania. I am Daniel Winter.
I'm Mark Ulissa. How are you, Daniel?
Doing good. Warming up here in Vancouver. Got into the pool for the first time with the family, so that's been nice. Of course, doesn't leave quite as much time for games as we'd like, but I know, coming back from the pool, powering up some Nintendo 64 on the old emulator. It's gives you a punch in the old nostalgia there.
It's always a good time for Nintendo 64, if you can find any good games to play on it. That's my little joke for the day. Very cool. I somehow managed to get myself sick. Well, my wife was sick for a while there, and then I guess I managed to get it in a delayed fashion, so that's why this episode might not be going out, you know, on the same day as we usually put it out. But I didn't want to delay another week after our recent week off, so here we go.
Yes, summer continues to throw interferences at us, and we'll probably be taking a summer break at some point. I know you're going on vacation at the end of the month, so we'll try and get in everything we can in the meantime.
That's right, and for this episode, I don't know, hold me to it. I'll try and talk a little bit less than I usually do. Shorter, perhaps.
That's fine. I think talking is fine. That's what people are here for. I think what we want to get to is a little more interaction. I did have some feedback today that people enjoy when we have more of a conversation back and forth. We've both played the same game. I think it's always been our focus and what we enjoy the most. It's just been hard to schedule. But that said, we do have another tabletop game that we've played today. Before that, we'll get to some appetizers. So I think I'll jump straight in there, if you don't mind, just to throw off the lead from the opening there. Sudokuvania. I saw an article from Thinky Games about this trend. There's a few sort of independent browser games that have come out, one called Sudokuvania Digits of Despair by Skeptical Mario. It's apparently a bit of a quite advanced puzzle, but plays with this sort of real mega structural Sudoku that, like, sprawling across multiple mini puzzles sort of combined into one larger one with some sort of special rules and sort of a fog of war of the map, and you have to, like, expand, like, the map sort of expands and sprawls in some fun different ways. But I was followed up by another game called Super Sudokoid Final Transmission, which the article had suggested that it was a slightly easier entry point. So I jumped into that and then had a quick poke around. Couldn't make a lot of sense of it, partly because it seemed like it's designed for special, like, readers or browsers that I couldn't zoom in. It was very small and hard to figure out. And I don't have the strategies for Sudoku puzzles, but it's a cool concept. And playing with some sort of real meta-structural gimmicks with that Sudoku formula.
Nice, yeah. I think I heard about a Sudoku, like, murder mystery game or something like that being talked about. I don't remember the title, though, so I can't speak much towards it.
Yeah, I mean, so many of those old, murder mystery puzzle books, basically the process of elimination was very similar to a Sudoku puzzle, I imagine. So it wouldn't be that, like, the logic tables that you'd sort of set up to eliminate certain suspects and murder weapons and things. But there is a specific book, you're right, Myrtle or something, I want to say. I don't know. There's a few of those puzzle books that have been quite popular now.
Very nice. All right, I will move on to a semi-good story. We promised fewer or no bummers in our news stories these days. This is a business story, but it's somewhat positive. People are probably aware that the blockbuster now title Subnautica 2 released fairly recently, just about a month ago, about at this time of audio release. I intentionally haven't purchased it because I heard that there was some disputes between the publisher and the developers. There was something of a parting of ways, and I understand that it had something to do with the initial agreement to have a bonus of $250 million upon release. And apparently, the publisher has come around. And this is a publisher that
forced
has to
come around, I think.
Yeah, exactly. This is probably just to, you know, make themselves look good. But they've essentially come around and agreed to do that payout of that initial $250 million to the developers. So this is just kind of them getting what they promised to give, or them getting what they were promised that they would be given. So I think that's an overall good thing. I don't know if I'm jumping, you know, out the door to get my copy of Subnautica 2 right away, particularly because I didn't get very far in Subnautica 1. But I think it's a nice thing when developers get what they're promised.
Yeah, I never finished the first one, but I had enjoyed it. I'd been curious about the second one to see how it evolves. But prior to all of that falling out, I had heard that they were utilizing AI, or that Krafton, the publisher, was very pro-AI instead of trying to enforce that. Of course, that led to this current shakeup where the CEO of Krafton had been told by various legal consultants, do not use AI to fire your workers. And then that's exactly what he did.
Of course.
My understanding is that the publishers have insisted that no AI was actually used in the making of the game, and they have been reinstated at the company. So, you know, it's hard to resolve all issues and misgivings with supporting the company and the various ownerships with any big studio these days, unfortunately. But in most cases, it seems like a fairly happy ending for all involved there.
Yeah, I think this just continues, you know, my belief that, you know, the video game industry doesn't need to exist as an industry, but I support video game creators 100%. And there's never going to be any lack of video game creators. We have so many talented ones already. We just need to get a better industry to support them, or give them more tools to be able to publish themselves. I know it's not easy. It's easy enough for me to just make simple statements like that. But things have to change from what they're like currently.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of buzz this last week about various outlets covering Forza, the latest Forza game, which is falls under the BDS boycott and things like that. But I mean, it's, again, hard to resolve all the feelings on that, but I have been moving towards focusing on more indie games, older games and indie games, one of those coming up a little later today. But in the meantime, one larger game I have been excited about is that there was a stream for the 40th anniversary of Dragon Quest. Not without its own controversy. I know the musician, the composer associated with that has quite a storied history, unfortunately. But this stream included, I can't remember the name of the CEO, but Yuji Horii, creator of Dragon Quest, was there as well, announcing that Dragon Quest 12 is still coming out, though they have completely retooled and restarted the development on that game, apparently. So it's already been like 10 years since the last game. Quite some time, but I guess they're struggling to find the exact vision that they want for that. But it is coming, apparently. Beyond Dreams, Dragon Quest XII.
Yeah, it's never a good sign when you have to reboot a game from scratch. And it's happened a few times recently. Not always to bad results, but not you know, encouraging news, let's just say.
Yeah, we'll see. I did really enjoy 11, and I've been retroactively enjoying some of the older games in there. So I'm looking forward to seeing what there's something coming out there, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I say that I loved the HD remakes, or number 3 anyways. I really enjoyed it early on, and then I realized that it's just kind of lacking something. It's not a very super coherent story in that game. It's so old and rudimentary.
It's like going through the motions a bit there.
Right, and then the new polish and shine that they've applied to it just kind of makes it feel a little bit soulless.
Yeah.
A little bit, lacking of,
You feel that emptiness just, with all that modernization, yeah. Makes the base palette, the base like base canvas feel a bit flat.
So it just kind of feels like a super polished turd, excuse my language there, but, it's kind of feels like it's a bit missing the point. And this is from someone who enjoyed playing Dragon Quest in its original format, all warts and all. So, I don't know, maybe I should retry some of the newer titles in the series and see if I enjoy them more.
I'm still working through the original version of 7 and quite enjoying that for what it's worth.
Cool. Okay, my next story is a totally wholeheartedly good news story. This was reported on Aftermath initially, and we'll share the links to the post here. But essentially, there's an annual exhibition, and it's called Famicase. And Fami comes from Famicon, or Family Computer, as the NES was originally called. And this is basically just an online exhibition where they bring together like fan art or art by artist contributors. They're legitimate artists, but this is not art for games that ever existed. These are not games that ever were real on the Famicom or real at all. They're just imaginary, and they're kind of like bordering, their framing, their canvas is the Famicom cartridge, which is that kind of very wide and rectangular format. Actually, not a very large amount of space, but it's somehow still manages to be a canvas to some really evocative art, especially the Super Mario 3 Japanese artwork on that is just really incredible. And this cartridge shape is nothing like the one for the NES, the big kind of rectangular or square kind of brick that you might recall if you grew up in North America. Anyways, I was reminded of that and also reminded of a book that you and I saw at Golden Age Collectibles the other day. I kind of held it up to you and showed you that there was a Mega Man comic, a Mega Man manga, and it really caught my eye because it was the spitting image of a Mega Man Famicom cartridge with that distinct horizontal layout, and of course they recreated that for the manga, and of course the mangas were displayed on their side, unlike the vertical orientation, the tate orientation, that books are generally treated to in North America. So I thought that was super cool and a nice kind of homage to those original pieces of artwork. And yeah, if you have a chance, listeners, just kind of go online, search out the Japanese Famicom box art for the Mega Man games, the Final Fantasy games, the Mario games, and you'll be treated to really colorful, imaginative artwork that's nothing like the stuff you grew up with in North America. So, and that that art exhibit, Famicase, is a brilliant kind of homage to that.
And so these are like Mario or Sonic games that don't actually exist. That they've sort of imagined sequels those series.
Yeah, the Famicase exhibit is about not real games, games that they've invented. I think there's like a strip poker game or something that has like saucy artwork or whatever, something they wouldn't have actually released, certainly not in North America. Although I think there were maybe some strip like Mahjong or whatever in Japan at some point.
I'm reminded actually of a video, YouTube video from Super Eyepatch Wolf, who's reviewed a lot of sort of weird esoteric games. And he did a video on You Cannot Play These Games. That's basically all about this sort of outsider art of invented games. People making whole guides, like strategy guides for games that don't actually exist. A lot of them sort of tend towards sort of Dark Souls style games, like ones that have a lot of mystery and sort of esoteric uncertainty around them. But just sort of a lot of weird gothic horror art. So at least those are the ones that he focuses on. I think he may have actually done a second video on those as well. But I thought that was really interesting as a sort of weird sort of outsider art of the ephemera that video games and their communities build.
That reminds me of something that I did with my kids when they were growing up and they were really, really small. This was years ago. I, you know, just had a strategy guide of like Ocarina of Time. It was like one of those Prima guides or whatever in English. It was just like, I would read it to my kid as like bedtime stories and they would want to like look at all the maps and all the little microscopic screenshots and whatever. And eventually that like Prima strategy guide was like just tearing apart at the seams, like the spine was just broken apart and now it's a piece of shredded paper. But I can't help but think that that experience made my kid grow up into the Legend of Zelda fan that they are. And it was pretty enjoyable to share that experience of strategy guides with them, because I guess that's not a thing that exists anymore, not in the same form. It's just all wikis online, isn't it?
True. Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said about the strategy guides or even the manuals. Like when you couldn't actually finish the game or couldn't play it as much as your parents allowed, perhaps, like just diving into that strategy guide instead and just the evocation of imagining what was possibly going to come up later in the game, parts that you never didn't even see yourself.
Right, and you know, if you didn't have, you know, a personal computer, let alone a cell phone in your pocket, you know, you couldn't just print off artwork from online or whatever. So like sometimes those strategy guides were like the main source of like artwork, high fidelity artwork, the largest form that you could find. If you couldn't get a poster of a particular video game that you loved, you know, that would have usually full color character art, let alone screenshots of maybe Vista's scenes, special endings that you didn't actually see. It was really evocative stuff, and I can see how it would be appealing to create something like that for an imagined game, because if you don't have video game development chops but you have an active imagination, then you can create your game in some form or other.
Yeah, I'll dig up those videos and drop the links in the show notes. I remember quite enjoying those.
Very nice.
Okay, shall we get... Oh, sorry, I had one more bit of news. That's right. Just Out of curiosity, I noticed that there is a new expansion coming out for The Witcher 3. That's a game that originally came out in 2015. So, I mean, I don't know that it's unprecedented. I'm sure there's been a longer gap that's not quite coming to mind. But it's a long period between releases and expansions for a game, basically. It's what's called Song of the Past. It's due to come out next year in 2027.
Yeah, it's probably not the longest gap between expansion content releases. I think there's been like 20-year ones, but like, you know, in cartridge form or whatever. So not exactly large scale.
I want to say like Neverwinter Nights or one of those D&D style games, I want to say, had an expansion of a similar range. I can't recall.
Yeah, we should look that up.
Yeah.
Very cool, though.
Yeah, did you play The Witcher 3?
I did. I didn't play it very long, though. Something about it kind of turned me off. I guess I was coming from the kind of like the Bethesda style where you make your own hero and you kind of make your own adventure. And then trying to step into Geralt's shoes rubbed me the wrong way. This was before I had watched, you know, the TV show, which I quite enjoy. I think it's pretty good. And, you know, come to love that character for his gruff nature and seeing that he's more than just the gruff, tough guy, you know. So I haven't read the novels or anything, the original source material, but I think I would like to give it another shot. Apparently, it has outstripped Skyrim of the most selling? I'm not sure what the original stat is, but it's outselling Skyrim anyways, which is a big feat.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the base game. I don't know that I ever finished the expansions. If I recall correctly, by the time they came out, I couldn't remember how to play the game. And like the first one, I had like this big boss fight at the start that I couldn't get past because I couldn't remember the controls. And so I think that's something that expansions really struggle with. And re-onboarding you again into the mechanics, I think that's an ongoing issue with a lot of the games. Horizon Zero Dawn was one I had similar issues with. So I'm hoping they, you know, 10 years, we're all a little rusty now. I'm hoping they come up with a system to overcome that.
Yeah, I'm rusty when I haven't played a game in a month. So 10 years is far too long. Anyways, let's talk about a deeper bite into some games then, shall we?
Shall we take some small bites first for some of the games of individually playing, or go big on the shared game there?
I think we did the shared game first last time, so why don't we mix it up and do the little smaller games first?
Okay.
I have just one other game than the main one, so why don't you go first?
Sure. Just quickly, I have played a board game. It's been increasingly hard to get to the table, but one that I did play this last week is called Oak. So this came out in 2022, designed by Wim Goossens, artist by Messier Janik, published by Game Brewer, who unfortunately went out of business a year or two ago, and I grabbed this at the time knowing it was going to be much harder to find. And so it is a kind of a worker placement game. You have these little druid meeples that you're placing out into this shared area or some of your personal areas. But an interesting mix of like worker placement and card placement. It's not quite as distinct as something like Lost Ruins of Arnak. There's some gray areas. Sometimes you need the card, sometimes you need the worker, sometimes you need both. It's a lot of different options there. But like every card you play has like three options you could use with it. So everything you do, you're like removing opportunities from yourself. It's a very tight game. In terms of the action opportunity, it reminds me a little bit of Underwater Cities. What's that designer? You probably
Tsuchi?
Yes, yeah. It reminds me a lot of a Tsuchi game in terms of that real elegance of action economy, making every turn work, and a real sense of like there's five or six different things you could be focusing on. You've really got to pick a lane. You cannot go wide, and so it's a real Moorish sense of, oh, next time I want to try focusing on this part of the game, because you can go and collect creatures that each give you some abilities, or you can collect artifacts that you can sort of reactivate multiple times, or you can climb the trees. The druids will have this party at the bottom of this big tree, and then they get drunk apparently and climb the tree, it seems. You can also dress up the druids, which is one of the big sort of table presence elements. So these little hats and satchels you can put on them to like superpower them and give them special abilities. It's a little bit of a trap, it feels like, because you might only get to use those abilities once or twice. So it's a game that's going to require a couple of plays. So we're going to get a sense of that tempo because it's so tight in terms of how many turns you're going to get. It's compelling. It's not exactly reinventing the wheel in terms of it. It's just remixing a lot of similar mechanics, like the going up these various tracks feels like. So the Terra Mystica cults and the sort of Lost Ruins of Arnak sort of card worker placements. But it's a fun theme with a lot of table presence. I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting, actually. It's a card game, you say?
Oh, well, a board game. Board, meeples, some card, play, bit of everything.
All right. Well, you said Tsuchi. I enjoy his game design, so that sounds very interesting to me. I promise that if you ask, I will play that game with you.
Let's make a date.
All right. I will cover a game that I've been playing recently. It is a video game, but it is something from the retro side, which I haven't actually covered in a little while. So let's talk about this. The game I'm talking about, I guess I'm talking about like two different versions of it. The game is originally called Front Mission. Front Mission is a series that's been kicking it for a long time. The first one came out originally in 1995 for the Super Famicom, which is the Japanese edition of the Super Nintendo, essentially. I don't think that ever came out in the West, so I didn't play it in that original format. Although I think you can get fan-translated ROMs if you have console. And I purchased it most recently because they remade the first two entries, Front Mission 1 and 2. They came out at the same time. This was in 2022, I think. And then more recently, they re-released or are just re-releasing Front Mission 3, which I do have more experience with. So what is Front Mission? Well, Front Mission was created, published by Square. This is before Square Enix. This is by Squaresoft, originally. And I think the developer's name is Gmode or something like that. This game is kind of cool if you like the future military fiction, near future sci-fi, somewhat reminiscent of something like Metal Gear Solid, things like that, where you have, high-powered mechs, and you have mercenaries boarding them and having, kind of paramilitary skirmishes. I guess this will appeal to fans of BattleTech and things like that, too. And actually, now that I have had a chance to play BattleTech more, I can see that there are definitely some crossover considerations. Essentially, my first experience with the Front Mission series was the third entry, which came out on PS1, I believe. And that game was in fully 3D. Well, it was still kind of isometric, but you can, look around the map. All the mechs were in polygon form, and it was kind of charming to see how low fidelity those mechs were then. And this version is much more polished on the PC, and it looks really clean. It runs really smooth, and the setting, all of it works. In fact, one of the most impressive things they've done is they have a really cool intro movie in Front Mission 1, which you might think, well, how did they have an intro movie on a cartridge-based system, Super Nintendo? Well, if you recall, we were just talking about Super Metroid recently, right? You've played that one recently Super Nintendo. That actually has a pretty decent intro movie.
Yeah, very moody, atmospheric, like evocative of aliens. I remember quite enjoying that.
Right, and they do some interesting things like transparency and layers and panning and cutting. And it's very like cinematic stuff that they're doing on pretty rudimentary technology. Mostly
on the
like
editing 2D. Rather than the right. The graphics, right?
Exactly. You could do that sort of thing back then that you just couldn't do in 8-bit. And they did that in a very smart way with the Super Nintendo version. What they've done is that they've completely remade that in 3D. And it's so faithful. Like every cut is the same. But they've done it in like intense, high fidelity. And it just makes you think, these guys are doing it right. These guys respect the original form and they kind of get what the fans are here for. So, like I said, I started playing it on PC, Front Mission 1. And let me just say, it is super smooth. It plays great. It looks good. And another great thing about Front Mission is that the artwork is quite nice. It features character artwork design by a very famous Japanese artist, one you might be familiar with from some other games that we've covered recently, his name being Yoshitaka Amano. And if you aren't familiar with this person's name, he does the kind of the 2D concept art for the Final Fantasy game series. So, and all the logos, the logos for every entry of Final Fantasy he's done. I believe every mainline entry of Final Fantasy he's done. And if you see those great you know, character art, concept arts for Final Fantasy, you know, 4 or whatever. Those are all him. Very whimsical style. I was used to seeing his artwork in the fantasy genre, so it's a little bit jarring to see it in modern, because this is like, you know, 21st century sort of stuff. You know, rugged mercenaries and things like that, and guns, not swords and armor. But it fits, it works, it's evocative, and the characters are appealing. But something just rubbed me the wrong way about the PC remake. Don't get me wrong, I'm glad it was made available, I'm glad it exists, and probably some people are going to pick it up and really enjoy it. I think you can play it on like lots of different consoles and PC. I think it's on Nintendo Switch, for instance. But so it kind of made me feel a little bit like Star Wars Special Edition. Do you remember Star Wars Special Edition? Like maybe, you know, as a child you watched Star Wars rented on VHS tape and it was the original format from the 1970s and 80s.
Like Han shot first, you mean?
Yeah. And then they came out with a later one around, I don't know, end of the 20th century or whatever. I forget what year it was, with extra CG scenes and things like that. And there was Jabba the Hutt walking around on his stubby little hind tentacles. And you saw stormtroopers riding on Dubaks and stuff. Totally unnecessary stuff. And basically, it just kind of felt like that. It's like, why did I pay for all this extra fidelity that I didn't need? I just kind of like wanted to go back and play on pixel forms. And as a result, I just kind of broke down and like, I want to start this over again. So I didn't go all the way back to 1995. I downloaded the Nintendo DS version. So they made a remake of Front Mission, the first mission, they called it, for the Nintendo DS in 2007 is when it came out. And that edition did come to North America. So this is not the first time. This latest PC remake is not the first time it came out in North America. I didn't play it back then, but I figured I paid for the latest and greatest. I'm allowed to download the ROM for the last version. And there was a PlayStation remake as well, which they borrowed a number of assets for to make the DS
version. Plenty of options for remakes then.
Yeah, absolutely. And the DS actually works fairly well. So it has a lot of the sprite work, obviously, which was what the original had. Totally works, fits naturally. And even in the 2D version, they had these kind of like cutaway action cutscenes. And in the Super Famicom version, presumably they literally did cut away. But in the DS, because you have two screens, you can have the tactical action happening on the bottom, and then you have the cutscene and other statistics show up on the top screen. So you feel like a little bit more immersed.
Tactics games did work really well on that format with the two screens and like the additional information that you can relay.
Yeah, exactly. Games like, you know, obviously, you know, your Fire Emblems and your Advance Wars. Another favorite series of mine, worked really, really well on the DS for that reason. So I think the 2D sprite work of the DS version still stands up. I prefer it to the new 3D version. So I'm playing that. I'm playing some of the earlier missions. And one thing I wasn't really aware, because I didn't get to play very much of the PC version, is that you can actually recruit additional mechs and pilots. Basically, every mission that you go on, the story is very kind of linear. You aren't given a lot of choice. You're not given a lot of choice into characterization or how you build your characters. You can't build your character. You're starting with the NPC, whatever you give the main protagonist character's name. You start with him. He's already pre-designed. You start with all the side characters, which are already pre-designed. But each mission presents you with... Most missions, let's just say, I haven't gone through them all, present you with an optional kind of like side character that you can oftentimes like have to rescue or you have to fight with, and you will earn their trust and then they will join your squad and then they can be deployed as additional units in your fighting force, each one being a separate mech pilot and a separate mech, and customizing the mechs and your character loadout is primarily how you get to customize and make the game your own. There's a wide range of parts. You can customize everything for basically the primary limbs. You got your body, two arms, two legs, shoulder mounted weapons or defensive items as well. And you have a backpack which can hold additional items. And even a CPU which gives you different stat bonuses for a variety of the different stats that you can have. And I said before that this game reminded me of Battletech, because in a satisfactory way, if you shoot off a shotgun or a missile blast at an enemy, you might just tear their arm right off before that they can counterattack you.
Sort of modular damage.
Yeah, and if you tear their arm off, then they lose the shoulder-mounted missile launcher and they lose the automatic weapon or the tonfa or whatever that they have equipped. So that's incredibly satisfying, just to have the kind of the risk-reward of, like, which of your parts do you kind of heal during, or do you tend to during the middle of a battle, and which, you know, how much do you push on the other guy to take out their equipment before that they can take out yours. It just feels really kind of like that same flair that Battletech has. So I'm loving the setting, I'm loving the gameplay, and, you know, I wish I gave it a little bit more in terms of story, but I feel like it's just beginning. Like, this, the story seems pretty complex. Not as heavy-handed as Hideo Kojima game or anything like that, but kind of a similar vibe of, let's just say, paramilitary, you know, Japanese sci-fi, like the Metal Gear Solid games, or even the other, like, Masamune Shiro properties, like Ghost in the Shell or Appleseed and things like that. So I think it's pretty cool. I'm going to keep playing and see how it goes, and I also bought the remake for the second one too, so I'll be playing that eventually as well.
Yeah, I was just looking at some screenshots. It looks a little bit like of the remake, that is, but it looks a little bit like XCOM in terms of the strategy layer, at least. But I've always wanted to get into like a mech game like Battletech, but I've struggled with just the crunch of all those stats to keep track of. It's a lot of work if you really want to min-max and make the most out of those games.
Yeah, it is. I've kind of just it is actually pretty fun. Like, you can kind of, like, I guess it's not exactly like Pokemon, but if you take out an enemy mech, like, sometimes, like, they will drop the gun or whatever equipment salvage, that they were equipped with. So you can salvage the pieces, you can swap them out on any of your mechs. It becomes quite fun to kind of tend to and care for. You have different paint jobs to the mechs. You can name them, give them nicknames and things like that. So they do really become kind of your own little babies that you tend to. So I guess that's part of the fun. Anyone who likes games where you can highly customize the party, like, the mechs are your party, essentially, in this case. So that is super enjoyable.
But yeah, I'll see. Have a look if I can try that out sometime.
Nice.
Maybe one of the older versions, preferably. So I mentioned Nintendo 64 earlier, just quickly. I've been continuing my work through the Castlevania series, following on from our Symphony of the Night discussion. I very quickly played a bit of a victory lap of the old style 2D action platformers, Castlevania Legends on the Game Boy. It was not much said about that. It was serviceable but largely forgettable game. It was only like an hour long, but it was a nice, you know, seeing out that style of game before the series sort of careens into a much different tangent. But before I get back to the Igarashi style Castlevanias, I have one little sidestep into Castlevania. I guess it's just called that, but it was on the Nintendo 64. I've only just started that, but it's surprisingly compelling. I know it's a bit of a maligned entry, but it's a series that hasn't had many attempts at a 3D structure. So surprisingly similar to Resident Evil so far. But I think it's dated surprisingly well, so I'm enjoying that right now.
Nice. Yeah, I have like a couple of 3D Castlevania sitting in my Steam account. I think like Shadows of Fate or something like that, or...
There was one on the Xbox. I got one of them on Xbox. I can't remember what it's called. It's like, it was two of them, Lords of Darkness or something.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I'm a little bit trigger shy to press start on those, let's just say. Mm-hmm. How did 64 manage it in 3D perspective?
I mean, this came out at the same year as Ocarina of Time, which I just played. So it pales in comparison to that in terms of the tightness of some of the lock-on mechanics and everything. They're still figuring out how 3D action works. But it is, like, surprisingly fast-paced. You can like, run around and fire off. Like, I'm playing one of the characters, you can fire off, like, magical missiles, like, home in. So you can be running and shooting simultaneously and attack and slide. And it's surprisingly expressive, like, moveset. I don't know that it evolves much over the course of the game, but I'm enjoying it so far. I'll come back to that when I'm done.
Now that you mention it, I'm reminded of a game I played on the PS Vita, I think it was. It was called, like, Severed or something like that.
Yeah, I saw that when I was looking up some information on it. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you recall that one, but I played it for a fair amount, and I thought it was an interesting take on a first-person action-adventure game that was on a portable system. So I was just thinking, you know, I know that the Castlevania had a storied series itself on DS. Like, I wonder how, like, first-person Castlevania would have worked on a touch-based system, because then you could have done, like, slashes and things like that with a stylus or something like that.
Like wizardry or something, maybe?
Maybe that could have worked in an interesting way. Like, it would have been a total diversion from a different parallel universe, but, you know, I'm not saying get rid of the ones that existed. I just think it would have been a fun experiment.
Yeah. Again, obviously, people keep saying Metroidvania as if that's a singular thing, but I've been most interested in these sort of weird sidesteps and in experimenting with different genres within those series. But the main game I wanted to talk about quickly today, a couple of episodes ago, I talked about a bunch of Morrowind-inspired games I'd played and hinted that there was one more. And this comes at that series from that inspiration a little differently. This is called Island of Outer Darkness. Came out last year, 2025. Designed by Zagaruch. I don't know how to pronounce that name, sorry. But basically as a solo creator. He did have some help with some character designs and things too, but it's largely the work of one person. And I largely don't like, you know, comparing these, especially indie games, to, like, defining these games in comparison to other games that they're like. Except that this game, like, literally has a list of inspirations, much like a TTRPG, which you don't really see very often in video games. One other exception I came across early this year was Baby Steps did a similar thing. It's like, hey, if you like this game, here's some others that inspired us and we think you'd like too. And I think that's, I mean, I think partly it's more of an indie video games, a little more understanding of sharing inspirations and acknowledging that maybe versus, you know, AAA games, bigger studios, a lot of chefs in those kitchens. But the board games still never have embraced that either. It's mostly been TTRPGs, and I'm curious why that is.
It's funny how these, I don't know, I guess more established game designers like to pretend like they don't play other games or that other games don't exist. I think there are a few creators that actually don't play other games.
Ryan Kitzier, I think.
Yeah, I guess that works for you, but, you know, like, I don't know. I guess you could always say that I don't want to be too influenced by other people, but, like, art is...
It's in conversation with other art, right? Yeah,
exactly. Art is theft, you know? Art is theft, art is recycling and reinterpretation, and also art is commentary. You know, you can comment on another game. You can have a game that is in conversation with another game, right? So many great ones like that Tunic game, you know? Like, where would that game be without Zelda, you know, and where would Hollow Knight be without the Castlevania series or Metroid? So, you know, play other games. Don't be shy.
But all that said, the top inspiration for this is Morrowind, along with various others like Disco Elysium and Nier Automata, and the Southern Reach series of books, and some other books that I'm intending to get to. But this game is... I mean, it's a third-person, sort of almost like a visual novel walking simulator. Basically, you're a postman sent to this small remote village on, like, the outskirts of the Empire. It's in this sort of fantasy world. It is somewhat evocative of Disco Elysium. It's sort of very, it's an empire in decline, or, like, it's very much, it feels very grimy, sort of, I don't know if it's industrial or sort of pre-industrial. It's hard to tell when you're out on the fringes. But you do get this sense of it being this really rich, sprawling world, and yet you're seeing it through the lens of these tiny little outskirts, like this huge empire from its farthest edge, basically, which is a really fascinating lens. And all the people in this town are like just wash-ups, like exiled political dissidents or just weird racists and outcasts who have just sort of accumulated in this small town. But you're the postman. You're going each day. You get 2 to 4 deliveries, and you go and talk to these people. But the dialogue system is basically Morrowind system, where you have a list of topics, and you'll select what topic you want to talk to them about, and they might elaborate on that, might get several paragraphs on a particular bit of a particular location or another person in town, and that might unlock other dialogue topics. That's all like completely irrelevant to the mail that you're delivering. You could just play this game and head down, like, here's your mail, move along. But there's so much other, so many other rich conversations and history and relationships that you can pull apart from this by like doing this sort of archaeology of talking to these various people. Because everyone in town, there's only like a dozen people in this town, but they all have thoughts on everyone else in the town. And I think it's just a fascinating way of world building. It's not even lore. It's like, I mean, I spoke about this recently, about lore being through the perspective of people living in that world. It's not this sort of official mandated, this is the history of this world, this is how things are. It's very much biased. You're experiencing this world through its like most cynical and racist and horrible people in many regards. So it's a fascinating way of exploring world building.
That is interesting. Yeah, having kind of like story and story that's at odds with the kind of the mechanisms that you're actually being asked to do. I think some of that sometimes, like we were just saying about games in conversation with each other, is like when the best results can happen, when you kind of have to like question, like, what am I doing? What's going on here? I'm sure I haven't been a postal carrier before, but I'm sure that everyone has worked a job where they're bored and their mind wanders, and you try and fill it with as much inspiration as possible. And, you know, dealing with certain customers are maybe more of a highlight and some are more of a downer. And I'm sure you got to feel that a little bit. Pros and cons when you're visiting the distinct residents of this island.
It's interesting because games like this, you often you're often playing as a bit of a blank slate and just a cipher. Like everyone likes you, and you would just want to ask all these questions. But it's clearly you're playing a specific character with their own sense of like they're a bit of an asshole, to be honest. Like they're really aloof and just ask too many questions and don't really give much back. Everyone's constantly asking you don't really give much back with all these questions that you're asking. And so that sort of plays into the interactions that you're going with. And I don't want to spoil too much because this goes in some fun places, because the title, Outer Darkness, is a volcano that you can constantly see in the distance. This is a very minimalist looking game, by the way. It's like all the characters are extremely simple geometric shapes, very blocky, but it's very painterly. Oil slick skies, and the character illustrations are all these abstracted shapes. It's really like quite striking in a very minimalist way. But Outer Darkness, this volcano, is just this silhouette that you can constantly see in the distance, regardless of the weather. It's always there because it can warp reality. And how, by what mechanisms it does so is a bit of a mystery, but sometimes you'll wake up and the buildings have moved, or it's raining blood, or the ocean has disappeared. But it gets to some really strange occurrences. One that blew my mind that I don't really want to spoil about is a second act that completely shifts your understanding of the player character, shall we say. So, some really fun, some sort of, like our next game that we'll be discussing, fits into this sort of genre of new weird or weird fiction, where reality kind of shifts away from your understanding and you can't quite nail it down.
It's your favorite genre of the exclusion zone, right?
Yes, exactly.
I think there was a, it's funny that there are so many games that tackle like mail delivery in a bunch of different ways. I seem to recall that there was a cozy game that featured like, I don't know, a woman who Lake? Changes her job. Yeah, Lake. Mm. That's right. It has kind of like a very kind of...
I really like that one.
Pastel, yeah. Or... gentle color palettes, painterly palettes, and just simple acts of delivering mail. And
it's a good structure for a game. Like, it gets you out and right. Talking to different people, and it gives some structure to your day, and it's a good formula.
Then there's that, like, kind of wacky, crazy taxi-style game where you're supposed to deliver mail as a tanuki or something like that. That came out recently. So you can tackle mail delivery in a bunch of different ways.
Exactly.
Okay. Speaking of a weird and wild... game, shall we talk about our main?
Yes, we've been going a little long, so let's get through that.
Okay, the game we're talking about is Wild Sea. This is a TTRPG that Daniel and I are both playing in the same party. We are both players, not the GM. I played it before at TCTC, right. I think, yes. A couple years ago. But, you know, that was only a one-shot, so our experiences are essentially the same. This is a PBTA-based system, so powered by the Apocalypse, which is not really that important to know, except for a few key touchstones, like the use of a few d6s and basically like mixed results. Essentially,
success with complications.
There you go. This game, interestingly enough, only one die matters. You can roll one die, or two, or three, depending on how many skills or attributes you have at your disposal, equipment, or other advantages that you have. But only the top value matters, unless you're rolling with, what is it called, slicing or something like that, where you cutting, where you take the top result out. Essentially, you want to be left with a high result of four or higher. Three or below is failure, four or five is a mixed success, and six is unadulterated success. And that's kind of at the heart of the mechanisms of the game, but there's a lot more than that. What other cool things are there, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to really quickly say that this was designed by Felix Isaacs and published by MythWorks in 2022. We are at risk of becoming the Forged in the Dark podcast, which is specifically based on that system. The only one which we've not played is the original Blades in the Dark. We've recently covered Cyberpunk and Scum and Villainy, and this is using that same system, but does have quite a few interesting twists on that, shall we say.
Well, I have played Blades in the Dark, so...
We haven't discussed it, though.
That's true. Yeah, so this game is interesting a lot of different ways. Additionally, we have to say that this game comes in a really kind of attractive, hardbound book with a lot of colorful artwork, very, very appealing, you know, hand-drawn artwork, no AI art here, and a lot of world-building as well. And you might argue, you know, like kind of unnecessary world-building, but what a world it is.
Yeah, I think we should start with that and sort of set the scene a little bit, because this is quite a unique setting. It's, I mean, basically, the shorthand is it's the post-apocalypse if nature won. Some event has occurred in the distant past where the entire world has been overtaken by greenery. I recently spoke about a book called Hot House, which brings to mind this as well. It's just rampant green everywhere, to the point that, like, there is no sea anymore. People are living on islands or on rocks, sort of, that, you know, jutting out from the top of the trees, the forest, and sailing boats along the top of the forest. It's basically a pirate game, but on the trees.
Yeah, I was given the very quick sales pitch, you know, when I had my initial one shot of it at TCTC. It was like, do you want to sail the seas of overgrown plants? And you can play as a bag of spiders. And I said, sign me up, I am there. And, of course, you don't have to play as a bag of spiders, but there are a bunch of different heritages, I guess you could say, a different biological, you know, some might say races, but they're basically like different forms that you can take. And what are there? There's like fungi people. There's like bird people.
I'm playing people, as a moth person.
Right. And I was that aforementioned bag of spiders. That's what I played in both my sessions. And I like, you know, like we were playing with our new RPG group. Aaron and Anna are our hosts, and Anna is playing a fungal creature, and we bond because we're both non-individual life forms. You know, we're like multi-life forms. So I like to think that we're a little bit superior to our single-bodied fellow party members.
Yeah, it's definitely falling into that genre of new weird. The main inspiration point that it cites is China Mayville, a book that a writer that I really like, specifically the Baslag series, that is like a fantasy world filled with cactus people and one of the books is, I'm blanking on the name, but The Scar, it's called The Scar, but it's basically pirates living in this floating flotilla, and it's got cactus people and like... weird spirits and a lot of breaking our conception of traditional fantasy and reality, and it's almost like more like sci-fi in a lot of ways, but in sort of ground level sort of civilizations.
Yeah, and this is where a lot of games and other media, you know, books like you said, or films or whatnot, will run into a challenge when you're dealing with the weird. Is like the question always comes up is like, well, how weird? How weird do you want to make it? Because like a little weird is generally appealing to lots of people because, you know, some little different hook will draw you in It's not your typical, you know, like Marvel action hero movie or something, whatever. There's some new stuff you've never seen before. But then if it's too weird, then people don't really have like a touchstone.
You need something to hang your hat on, you know, that's to hold on to sometimes, right? Yeah. It can feel like a lot of work to like to push forward and carry on the story and feel like you're having to try and contribute to the weirdness.
Right. So I think that this system did a really smart choice of making everything sort of this like ship-based pirate-themed sort of yo-ho-ho, but on the weird seas. A metaphor, because, you know, you can use that same language. Everyone kind of knows that sort of concepts from reading, you know, whatever, Treasure Island or whatever as a child, or watching Pirates of the Caribbean films or whatnot. Everyone kind of gets those like stereotypes and can get into it. And just the fact that it's not on water, but on overgrown undulating trees or whatever, just makes it have that extra flair.
Weird, but
that
familiar.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's what games need to really kind of grab you, like that Morrowind.
Hmm. But yeah, so you talk about some of these characters, and they each come with, or these bloodlines, I think they're called, and they each come with these aspects, basically. There's like each race has like 20 different aspects you can choose that you build at your character. You also choose a class, and they'll each have 20 aspects. But though each of those, like any one of those, could be this really fascinating hook to build a character on. And you can mix and match across any of the races, I think, but you can, it's there to give you a bit of guidance. Like, these are some good ones that work with this type of character, basically. So, I mean, one of mine, for example, is like, well, one of mine is just a staff. You can choose, it can be an item of gear or equipment or a pets, for example. But one is like, I keep charts, maps, charts on my wings. They're written on my wings. That's part of my character. Or one is that I have a sense that I can have this sort of uncanny ability to find things that are hidden. And that's one of my sort of aspects. And you pick like five or six aspects at the start of the game, basically.
Yeah, and you said it was from background, but it's also from your origin as well.
Right, so that's the other one I was forgetting.
You can have like a kind of like a biological background, and then you can have an origin, which is more of like your upbringing. So it's like nature and nurture, and you can pull aspects from each, as I understand it. You know, if I only made characters.
And your class as well. So I think there's three you're sort of pulling from.
That's right. So I think that does give like a pretty wide kind of canvas to pull from. And that's, once again, this is the constant danger of this system. This type of system is, well, if it's so weird, it's hard to get people to latch onto it because it's not just a D&D clone. You know, I don't know how to make my barbarian equivalent or whatever.
And if everyone's playing with these really weird characters, how do you get them to play nicely together when everyone's trying to show off their toys constantly?
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I think that this game succeeds to varying degrees. Like, I'm happy with the character I made, but I also don't feel like I am able to execute what I want at any given time. Basically, my character is a kind of like a poison crafter.
An alchemist? Essentially.
He's essentially an alchemist, but I wanted to make them sort of like a assassin in training that makes like poisons and things like that. And that's sort of my mission, is to go out into the world, learn about ingredients and make poisons. So some of my aspects are like climbing, because I'm an arachnid, so I can climb easily, acrobatic skills that make sense. And others that I pull from my origin are, as I think, are like a skill with languages or whatever. And then another one was like the ability to like concoct potions within my own stomach or whatever by ingesting ingredients. So you can get some cool, interesting results, but depending on what happens in the story, they don't always come to any fruit. And I guess you could say that about any RPG system, really. But, you know, it's hard to compare it to something like D&D, where basically like half or more of the game in D&D is just hitting things over the head, right?
Whereas here, if you hit combat and you haven't specifically chosen any combat skills, you might not have much to do. Like, maybe it was better that you avoid combat entirely, or maybe there's one or two characters and you just let them steal the spotlight for that combat and do the hard work, and you'll have your focus in other parts of the game. And I guess we haven't quite entirely fallen into the rhythm of that yet, but like, we had our first combat last session, and I can hit things with my stick, or I can try and come up with creative ways to do other things. But when you're on a ship, like, so many of these set pieces are going to be you're on your ship. It's a little bit limiting, perhaps. I'm not sure, I don't yet have a sense of how much we're going to unlock as the campaign goes on to, like, expand our toolbox. But yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it, but I can definitely see some limitations there unless we sort of tweak it somewhat.
Yeah, and I think that, this concern is not, wholly founded in all ways. You know, I've played PBTA games, I've run PBTA games as a GM, and, one of the hallmarks of it is another aspect we haven't covered yet, which is called clocks. So this game definitely does leverage clocks, and our GM uses them very...
very liberally.
very liberally. And it's very, very clear about what's going on, and I think he's doing a good job with that. But basically, clocks are sort of like a checklist or like a timer. So a clock might have a certain number of like ticks to it, and when you fill out all of the ticks, then that event disappears, or it comes to pass, or something happens at the end of that counter. And specifically, you don't always have just one clock. You might have multiple clocks.
Repeating clocks.
And the clocks might actually be, yeah, exactly, running against each other. So you might be trying to advance your objective, which is to succeed in the combat. And then the enemies are also succeeding in their goal, which might be like capturing your ship or something like that. So basically, RGM presents us with a dry erase board, which could have like 4 or 5 different clocks on it. And this is not unfamiliar to me, but it's still quite unfamiliar to the old school RPG players, I think. It's very, very different than a D&D scenario or even a Cypher system scenario where, here's 5 wolves and they have 12 HP each and you just have to bash them or hit them with fireballs until those hit points are depleted. It's a totally different foundation with which to run with. And I think this game has the potential to have interesting solutions to combat scenarios that might not include combat, Just because it is a combat doesn't mean you have to hit. You could find other solutions like, trapping the enemies or negotiating with them or knocking them overboard or, making the ground slippery or things like that. Basically, each of those clocks is all up to the GM to determine whether you've ratcheted up or not. There's no like numerical result you have to roll to get that number of points.
And it does give you a really tangible sense of your impact. Like you get 1 or 2 ticks or however many, like seeing your impact upon these tracks does impart a strong sense that you're having an effect on the world. It isn't quite as granular as like Say Scum and Villainy, which was like breaking down everything you do into like 3 different stats. So your impact and it was like 3 different stats that you could break any role against. Here, everything just comes down to impact, so it's simplified and keeps things moving without having to grind, like get into get the math out and sort of compare charts and everything. So I think it's quite simple here, and I think RGM has been really good at keeping the action going. This is a game that uses very cinematic terms, like montages and scenes. And I think to make it work well is to have an understanding of that and to keep the action moving forward, these liberal use of the tracks to sort of push things forward. Like it's an inevitability, right? Having these tracks there.
Moving just away from combat a little bit there. Like you said, there's different other tools that you use. So there's this concept of kind of journeying. So as you might imagine, a story about being on the high seas, whether they're made of plants or water, you're going from place to place. You're going into port, talking to people, pulling out of port, going chase down another ship, something like that, going to some pirate cove, whatnot. Basically, like you have time where you're traveling from place to place, and sometimes this is downtime. Sometimes this is quiet. This is where you patch up your wounds or you work on your personal projects. Or something like that. Or sometimes, you do get attacked in the middle of the night or whatever. But this system seems to use this journeying as a kind of that, like, downtime replacement. Like, the Forged in the Dark games definitely have a stronger emphasis on, like, main campaign and then kind of, like, epilogue.
Although I think journeying is actually distinct from the, like, the montages is the downtime equivalent. Journeying is this larger sort of subset of things that might happen, which includes almost this sense of like a hex crawl, traveling from A to B, and like you have to, like, who's on watch this shift, or roll to see how the watch goes and something might happen. So I think there is this sense of uncertainty as you're traveling. It's not just that those downtime actions.
Right. But typically you use this time to do basically just those two things, you know, heal yourself or work on a side project or something like that. And I find that it feels like a little bit too little, you know, that kind of the journeying. I feel like I want it to be a little bit more fleshed out, like maybe just even just doing two things in the middle of a journey, or just not there at all. You know, I guess it's good to have that little breather there, but it's definitely not extensive, or it's not even kind of that much fun to play. I guess you could consider it fun if you are advancing one of your character's personal goals.
But when you're using your montage just to heal, it feels like a bit of a sacrifice, because it is quite easy to take a lot of damage here, and with very limited options for healing. We've been struggling with that a little bit, I think. And the rules were a little bit unclear on how you heal, because there is a heal action that you can take in the montages, but then you have to, like, you have to use a resource and roll the dice, and you might just end up taking more damage if you roll badly. So again, there is some ambiguity in the rules. A lot of the rules feel like they're set out narratively quite well, but the impact on the rules isn't entirely explained particularly well. And it's explained more from a narrative perspective.
Yeah, and that could be, you know, it could be on me and yourself to know the rules a little bit more. I don't know. I've been running some RPGs recently, so I'm looking at this opportunity to just sit back and play for once. So I haven't read the rule book intensely, but I thought that was an interesting kind of balance. Ultimately, we're just learning now after a number of sessions that, yeah, it seems like the gathering of those resources and spending them is kind of the rhythm and flow of this game. Is like you can't just hoard them, can't just sit on them forever and hope that they become useful at a certain time. You're totally meant to spend them and lose them and gain more as you go along.
Yeah, it took a bit of time to wrap my head around those, because you start the game with some resources, and the implication is you're supposed to, like, name them. These are specific things that you have. It's not just a counter, but you're also expending them and as part of these larger actions. And so it's hard to get your head around the mental load of inventing a specific item that you're only going to use once. You know what I mean? I wasn't sure the balance to strike there, and how much effort do I put into each item that I'm creating.
Yeah, it's very different from a traditional RPG. You know, let's just say, put D&D aside, let's talk about another system I know fairly well, like Shadowrun, where, you know, you collect a bunch of new yen, which is the currency in the game, and there is a book cost for a clip of ammo or a cyber deck or a bulldog drone or something like that. You convert that new yen into, you know, because it's fungible, into that product, and you have that product on you, and it does a specific thing.
You get a shopping list, basically.
Yeah, it's a very different metaphor than that, and Powered by the Apocalypse games, PBTA games, leverage that more as these more kind of a loose currencies. And there's another one that we haven't mentioned yet, like the Scum and Villainy game, the Fortune in the Dark game Scum and Villainy that we did a feature episode on a little while ago. This game lets you customize your ship, and that's a very fun aspect, let's just admit. In any game where you ride on a ship, is that you as a party get to develop that ship together, and basically kind of our first session, or session 0.5, I guess, if you want to call it that, was essentially all of that. Five players, and the GM spent a bunch of time choosing aspects from the ship and kind of determining the very nature of it. You know, is it more mechanical? Is it more biological? You know, what are its characteristics? What sort of weaponry is it equipped with? What sort of engines is it equipped with? And that was pretty fun. And you know, another currency you can use is when you play the game, you can acquire cargo, sell it, and you gain what's called a stake, which is right, like the equivalent. It's like a kind of like a coupon you can turn in to buy another upgrade for your ship.
So even when you're first making that ship, each player gets like 2 or 3 stakes. And so you're already having to make decisions like, well, do I buy something that's good for the crew, or do I just pick my pet project that I really want an observation platform, or I really want a room to keep all my maps in?
Right, and this was one of my only real criticisms I had of the sessions that we've had so far. You know, I think that Aaron's doing a great job GMing, so this is no knock on you. Maybe this is just one thing that you have to do with this system, and no matter what. But I feel like that session sort of dragged in creating the ship, because despite how fun it is, whenever you get 5 people together who don't know each other very well and who don't know our characters very well, you know, you're pulling and pushing on that whatever ball of wax in every which way, and you can't quite get a compromise to land on something exciting. You only have 1 or 2 votes. So, you know, it all kind of ends up being like mush in the end. And I think we didn't even agree on all of the stakes that we would use. We like kind of left one open because we just couldn't decide.
Yeah, you do end up with this very hobbled together sort of box of scraps. Like it feels very piecemeal, this ship that we have, which is probably part of the point, I think. It's not, you know, a super crafted shiny ship. It's supposed to be, it's very lived in and shaped by each of its inhabitants.
It's like the bucket of bolts, like the Firefly or Millennium Falcon.
Well, that's one of the other, Firefly was definitely one of the big inspirations cited, yeah.
Yeah, that said, I think that maybe could have gone, like, since our particular party started off as a Discord first party, that we could have done some of that offline. I don't know.
We could have all done some more reading of the book, the first two, obviously.
It's hard to arrange this sort of stuff, so this isn't a knock on our GM or our party. It's just like maybe a step of caution that I would give for people that try the system on yourselves in the future.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I want to touch on is like reading through the book, and it's a huge tome. I haven't read all of it, but reading through the opening of it, it does an interesting job in setting this world, not through like history and lore, but through culture and anthropology, and like what are the implications of this world that you live in now. There's a lot of confusion. It's like no one really knows what happens, or no one can explain how the trees came to be this way or the history of what came before. And so there's this real sense of mystery and of the different civilizations and communities living within this. It's a very community-based game, and each community being its own island, I guess, in this literally and figuratively is sort of piecing together. And it was quite interesting reading through that in terms of, like I said, it's very, very anthropological perspective. It does get a little too granular sometimes in describing, well, here's the 3 different types of communities that you might, like the 3 different sizes you might come across, but doesn't really explain what that means in terms of gameplay sense. Like, you don't really need to break it down that granular level unless it has a gameplay effect, right? So it's a little confusing how much detail they go into sometimes. The other thing is that there are some fun implications of this world, like the fact that you can't have fire. Well, open flame is banned, sensibly. Like, there are ways around that, I'm sure. But that's one key fact that shapes the entirety of this world. Like, there's some raging fire off in the distance that's been like burning for like hundreds of years, because the greenery grows so fast that it's like it keeps growing back, and this fire is just circling around like the weather constantly. So there's some fun sort of world building aspects there without getting too stuck down into the lore and history of this world.
Speaking of world building, lore, and history, one thing our GM does really well, and I don't know if this is just something he chose to do or something that's written into the book, but at the beginning of every one of our sessions that we've done so far, he will do a little roundtable questionnaire and ask kind of like off-the-wall questions. I don't know if these are prompted from specific lists or maybe an app even, but like one of the examples was, I think recently the GM asked me, you know, what is a certain slang and how is it used in the system? And another one was, there is a painting called this, and what does it represent in this world?
Well, I wrote down a couple of these. Why is cuisine of tanned stretches so hated? Or what is the strange beauty trend moving through bitter messing? And these are places that we don't have any point of reference to. Like, we've not been to these places. But, like, good job, by the way. This was the segue I was leading into this, discussing this mechanic. And I haven't found it in the rules. So, again, maybe it's just a GM tactic. But it does create this really interesting sense of collaborative world building. And it's almost like, you know, everyone derides the whole meeting at the tavern as an opening of these games. But this feels like meeting in a tavern as a sort of rumor mongering. Did you hear about these people over in Bitter Messing and there's this weird thing they're doing? Like, it can be a little Mad Lib sometimes and how everyone's, you know, throwing ideas at the wall to see what sticks. But I don't know, it's a fun way of bringing everyone in together, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's a brilliant way to overcome that issue of, is it too weird?
Mm.
Because if you can let the players realize, hey, this is all a safe space here, there's no judging, and that letting them, like, choose and to, like, indelibly alter the shape of the universe in their own small little way, it lets the players have a strong sense of ownership on it. And I think there's this psychological thing called the endowment effect, which is like, you like something that you make more other than an equivalent thing that somebody else made. It's the reason why people like IKEA, is because, like, you feel like it's worth more because you put a small amount of effort, personal touch into it. So, you know, like, just this last session, they asked me what that slang term was. And then later on in that session, I pulled the phrase of slang out on some of the NPCs that were acting in the world space. And, you know, that was meaningful to me. And it just made me feel like, yeah, this is our game, you know, not that other group's game of Wild Sea or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, because I was thinking that the GM hasn't really thrown, like, there haven't been any callbacks to any of these things that we've invented. Like, we haven't gone to any of these places since then, but maybe I've been thinking about it incorrectly. Like, maybe it's more about, like, this is getting our creative juices flowing and we should be bringing more of these flavors back in as callbacks potentially. But regardless, it helps everyone get invested and set the tone of what, just how weird do we want things to get here.
Yeah, I mentioned that I was running Aetherreich and recently, so that game, like, very specifically asks its players to narrate as much as the GM does, and I stated that to the group, and my neighbor RPG group, like, at least two of them are at least, so that's half of the group, are GMs themselves, so they should be used to this. But somehow or other, I wasn't able to tease it out of them to, you know, contribute in the strong narration. I guess because it's kind of like taboo in most RPGs, is like that's the GM's job, and they're God. And hands off or whatever. But this one, I feel like that kind of line of questioning gives you license to contribute more. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if we want to get into too much more detail. We're running a little long here. But, like, I am really enjoying this. I love the world that we're exploring. We've only seen, like, a tiny pocket of it so far. I'm keen to see some of the other communities. Of, like, where do the mushroom people live? Where do the cactus people live? What's going on there? Each character has, like, their own, like, goal. I'm not sure how those are going to get pulled in, whether the GM is going to, like, introduce those at some point, or whether we have to sort of force the hands a little bit in making those come to be. But there is a lot of ambiguity to this world, to the rules, for better or worse. It does have a bit of a mental load in navigating that. It does work best if you're keeping an open mind and playing more into the narrative sense and not getting too stuck into the crunch, I guess. And the rules do have a lot of suggestions, like you could remove some of these mechanics or some of the narrative aspects and make this, like, rather than your actual, it's like the whispers, for example. There's this concept of whispers where these literal sentences that your character keeps in their head, and when you say them out loud, it will have, like, this impact on reality. And that is a diegetic rule mechanic in the game, but you could also abstract that instead, and rather than influencing reality, just pull it back to be an abstracted player ability. And so there's various suggestions in there to, like, how you can tweak how you think about this world and how you're impacting it. But there are lots of options there, but it's a lot to take in and absorb what your options are.
Yeah, I should really read that chapter, because until the very most recent session, I didn't know what whispers were or that they existed at all. And my character, as of yet, doesn't have any whispers, so I was playing without all the cards in my deck. I should probably figure that one out.
Well, like, my character starts with a whisper, like a sort of narrative parasites that you have, but I wasn't sure, like, do I need to have the actual phrase? Do I need to invent a phrase myself? Or do I just have this that I can come up with a phrase in the moment? Like, how much do I need to nail this down in advance? But I guess that's up to us to some extent.
Right. I don't know. I always say whenever PBT comes up that I really enjoy City of Mist, just because, like, just the phrases, you know, the 12 phrases, the tags that make up your character, totally makes sense. Like, it's non-numerical. It is like a description. It's a literal description of your character, and it is just so elegant. And a lot of all of these different desperate components, I think, and new terms and new terms of phrase do tend to confuse one, even, you know, someone as experienced with TTRPGs as me. So I can't imagine how difficult it might be to take on, or how daunting it could be to take on a new game, especially when it's like this big bulky tome, like the one that this one comes in. Even though overall, if run well, it's a very user-friendly and straightforward game.
Yeah, it is very elegant. There isn't a lot of maths and numbers. It's mostly just like you've only got like 2 or 3 pips in a particular skill. You add that to one of your attributes, and that's how many dice you roll, basically. So it's fairly simple, low crunch in that regard. It's just a matter of keeping in your head all of your options, like all of the downtime options, or all the capabilities you can be pulling on that aren't sort of referenced on those player sheets. So again, maybe I just need to read the rules more and have a better sense of what's in my toolbox exactly.
Yeah, on that point, my final comment is that I still am not sure how character progression will go. We haven't really delved on that. I know it's early yet, but we haven't done like a lot of like end of game kind of questionnaires and interviews like a lot of other PBTA games have, you know, tick off how many times you did this or that. And we haven't touched upon that at all, I think. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes, if there is much emphasis on character progression at all.
Yeah, I believe most of those, like, you use these milestones as a sort of currency that you can spend mostly to like expand those tracks, and you can like add an extra pip onto your tracks that define your character, basically. It's quite expensive to get a whole new track entirely, so I don't know how often we'll be adding a completely new tool to our toolbox, but I think the resources are supposed to fill in some of the gaps there as well.
All right, cool. Well, we could talk about this for a while, but I'm sure we'll revisit it in the future.
Yes, yeah. I think we'll be taking a break over the summer with GM going away, and we're all going to be quite busy. So I wanted to at least get some opening impressions on this while we're fresh.
Nice, nice. All right, shall we move on to a dessert topic?
Yes, we'll keep that short too. And I'm actually going to change up from what I had in the notes, because our conversation earlier reminded me of something else I wanted to discuss. Very quickly, I watched a film called Phenomena. So this is directed by Dario Argento. I came across this on Tubi. I've not seen any of his other films. I just know that he's widely regarded as one of the sort of the primary directors involved in the Giallo movement, the sort of Italian thrillers. This is quite interesting. I think it was 85, early 80s, I think. But it's Jennifer Connelly. I think she's like 15. This is pre-Labyrinth. Jennifer Connelly is sent to this remote boarding school. Is a serial killer on the loose, murdering some of the other students. Turns out that she can also control bugs with her mind telepathically. How that's going to be useful in facing a serial killer, you have to watch and find out. But she, like, is this entomology professor that she befriends, who also has a pet monkey. Second movie in a row that I've watched that has a monkey sidekick. It's a weird trend, but it's very strange. It's certainly wonky. It's one of the strangest deployments of Iron Maiden that I have seen in a film. It does not match the editing of the scenes that appears. I think there's Megadeth in there as well, so it's very strange, but really cool synthy, like the original soundtrack. I really like it. It's actually very reminiscent of Labyrinth and that very sort of 80s synth going on there. Quite strange, a bit of an exploitation flick, but I quite enjoy that as a weirder one. And what I reminded me of that is apparently was the primary inspiration for another little survival horror game called Clock Tower.
Yeah, Clock Tower is an older game, isn't it? That was for like Super Famicom, I think.
95, I want to say. So I want to go back and check that out.
Same year as Front Mission. Must be something in the water. Well, we all know, Daniel, that you only watch movies with cheeky monkeys in it. That's your kind of fair oeuvre, right? Okay, let me talk about a book that I read recently. Thankfully, it's short, so I don't have much to say on it. But it's related to something that you covered recently. Mm-hmm. So I read the novel Strange Pictures, which is by the author Uketsu, who's the pen name, of course, Japanese in origin. And this is actually the follow-up to the book that you covered a little while ago. What was it, Strange Houses?
Yes, that's the one. Yeah, I think there's a third one as well. I can't remember the name.
Yeah, it's a whole series, apparently. I think it says that Strange Houses was in 2021, and Strange Pictures, 2022. There's Strange Buildings that was released in 2023 in Japan, and the forthcoming Strange Maps. So this is becoming quite the empire. So I don't know entirely how closely this maps to Strange Buildings, but we'll see based on my description of it. It's a short novel. It says 500 pages in my Kobo, but it's surely not that in paper.
Most of that's images, I'm guessing, if it's anything like Strange Houses.
Quite possibly, yeah. And, the numbering of those pages doesn't always work out in those ebooks. But I finished it in two or three sittings, so it was fairly short. It takes place over five short chapters. And fundamentally, it's a mystery story. And actually, five mystery stories, because essentially the five different chapters are kind of short stories in their own right, and they all have a beginning and an end and a conclusion that kind of wraps it up internally, and throughout there are a whole range of strange pictures, as you might imagine. And those pictures are a range of different, kind of qualities and styles, and they're by different individuals, certainly are in Strange Pictures. And annoyingly, quite a few of them were not pictures at all. Like, quite a few of them were just, like, graphs or charts or diagrams. Not pictures per se, but just, like, for instance, there was one case where there was a murder and they were trying to figure out alibis. And it was just, like, a diagram of... They couldn't have had it at this time because they had an alibi that covered this period. So, not a picture at all. Kind of a cheat, I think. Anyways, these five different stories are told in a very kind of a creepy way. And I think that this author is doing some impressive stuff with everything that they basically, they don't say. And I think this is a quality of Japanese writers, and maybe Asian writers as well, I'm not sure, of... A lot is left unsaid, a lot is left kind of to interpretation, and there's not a lot of flowery descriptive language.
Were you reading in English or Japanese?
I was reading in English.
Okay, yeah, because that was one issue I had with it. It felt very flat and just matter of fact, and I wasn't sure if it was something lost in translation or if that's just a stylistic thing.
No, I think that's accurate. I mean, there are different writing styles in Japanese as well, so I don't want to paint it with too broad of a brush. But of the Japanese books that I've read in English, even they have a range in styles. And this one reminded me a little bit of more of that, what was that one? The biography about the person who does nothing. It kind of read more in that style, kind of very terse, very short and to the point. So I imagine that that's just the style of this author. And I think this novel was serialized potentially, perhaps on social media. In Japan there and other countries.
That's right, yeah.
There are different ways to publish books, and this concept of web novels is very popular.
It reads more like a Reddit creepypasta or something. And maybe it comes across better piecemeal rather than as a sit down with a book experience.
Yeah, that said, I found it very, very compelling. I kind of basically read some of these long chapters, and there are few, but they're longer chapters. I kind of read them right through. And very, was struggling to break away from them because internally they are very kind of, they move with a swift pace, and that I enjoyed quite a bit. And I thought you initially think that these stories are unrelated, but wouldn't you know it, you'll find that perhaps the stories are connected in more ways than you might think. So, trigger warning, of course, these are murder mystery stories and cases of missing people. There is a decent amount of death, and there's some amount of violence in this story as well. So if you're a little squeamish, you may not want to pursue it. But I like how much misdirection there is in the story. And the other novel that I was reminded of that was The Night of the Baba Yaga, which is also another kind of high-intensity story. A story that can only be told in a novel. because what is not said is as important as what is said. And I think that if you saw everything going on in a, like a film or a TV show per se, then it would give it all away. So definitely read this in paper form or ebook like I did, and you'll really appreciate this rollicking mystery story. A high-tempo mystery story, I think. Very easy to read. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
It moves at a very snappy pace.
Yeah. So I guess I'll have to check out Strange Buildings, too.
And I did see there's a manga that recently came out. I think of Strange Buildings, really? I want to say. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, does my description about sound the same as Strange Buildings?
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's not... I mean, it's pretty clear from the get-go that there's no separate stories. It's all one continuous story. It's like broken up into several smaller modular parts. Like there are several different houses. Like each chapter is a different house, but those houses are very clearly part of one larger mystery.
Mm. I think that this novel might be a little bit different, though, because like this story is told from different perspectives, and they do feel very distinct from each other, at least initially speaking. Anyways, I don't want to say any more, otherwise I'll give away the spoilers. But that novel I talked about is Strange Pictures by the author Uketsu, 2022. I read it via Libby from the Vancouver Public Library.
Excellent. Okay, running along today, so let's close up. If you have any questions or comments on today's episode, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com. or at our website, omnigamers.club. You can find me at Blue Sky, at Board Game Feast, and the Omnigamers Club account there as well.
All right, check out our videos that we post to YouTube. We put out a video of our episodes there every time they come out. And if you want to check out our older episodes, our oldest episodes are only available in audio, so you'll have to seek them out on a podcatcher of your choosing. Of course, you can always get them at our website, omnigamers.club. And wherever you find us, do leave a comment. We love to hear your feedback. We don't have any ads or anything like that, so feedback is what we live for. Please suggest a new novel to read, or a movie to watch, or a video game to play. We want you to, you know, feel like you're part of the club too.
Yes, always appreciated. A couple of quick plugs. Protocon BC coming up in November. Tickets just went on sale. So that's the convention's all about playtesting upcoming designs. So if either you have a game that you're working on, or just want to help be a part of, help make someone else's game a reality, that was great fun last year. Looking forward to it. The Vancouver Game Garden, showcase of locally made video games coming up this month in June, just a couple of weeks. So I'm looking forward to seeing what's been growing over there.
Yeah, if you're curious about Game Garden, I think we've done two episodes before.
Yeah.
So go check out our back catalog even to check that out. Very cool, Daniel. Well, I promised I wouldn't speak a lot, and I ended up breaking that promise, so what can I say? I should just stop speaking right there.
Bonus mark. Okay. Thanks to everyone for listening, and remember to have a balanced diet of games. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.